Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Iran looks forward to the lifting of sanctions. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says he expects sanctions on Iran to be lifted in the coming weeks after the UN nuclear agency ended its probe into allegations Iran once worked to develop a nuclear weapon. In a televised address on Wednesday, he said, "I tell the great Iranian nation that God willing, the sanctions will be lifted in January, and the government will fulfill one of its election promises. The chains of sanctions will be removed from the feet of Iran's economy, and the path will be open for more interaction with the world." On Tuesday, the International Atomic Energy Agency unanimously approved a resolution to close its more than decade-old investigation into Iran's nuclear work. But on the same day, United Nations experts concluded that Iran violated a UN resolution when it fired a ballistic missile in October, a move that could lead to sanctions. A UN resolution prohibits Iran from launching ballistic missiles capable of delivering nuclear weapons. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has stressed to Iraqi leaders the desire of the U.S. and its coalition partners to accelerate efforts to defeat Islamic State group. Secretary Carter met with Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and Defense Minister Khaled al-Obaidi after making an unannounced visit Wednesday to Baghdad as part of a trip to seek more help in the battle against ISIS. Carter told reporters he discussed with both men the importance of building on their success to complete the recapture of Ramadi and then continue the campaign.
We have to defeat ISIL here in Iraq and Syria, where the parent tumor is. Now, we also have business to do around the world, because this is metastasized to other parts of the world, including our own homelands.
Secretary Carter also held talks with General Sean McFarlane. This is VOA News. The United States has called on Nigerian officials to investigate the clashes between army troops and a Shiite Muslim sect that reportedly left hundreds of people dead. The U.S. Embassy in Abuja said Wednesday that the Nigerian government should hold to account any individuals found to have committed crimes. A video posted to YouTube purportedly shows the initial confrontation Saturday between the army and members of Islamic Movement for Nigeria in the northern town of Zaria. Activists and sect leaders say up to 1,000 Shiite Muslims were killed in army raids that followed the initial confrontation. The United States and Russia appear to have bridged some differences on ending the Syrian conflict, with Moscow endorsing a plan for a third round of talks in New York on Friday to discuss a political transition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in the Russian capital meeting with President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Mr. Kerry also indicated the U.S. is not seeking a regime change, that a reference to President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Opposition leaders in central Ethiopia say security forces have killed more than 40 people in recent weeks amid protests against a government-developed plan. The demonstrators began holding rallies late last month over a plan to expand the city limits of the capital of Addis Ababa. Critics in Ethiopia's Oromia region say the plan would displace local farmers and rob the area of its autonomy. The government puts the death toll from the protests at 5, not including 4 police officers, it says, were killed Tuesday in Oromia. A devastating attack on a school in Pakistan 1 year ago is considered a milestone that changed the country's strategic direction. The military establishment that was frequently blamed for supporting non-state actors against its neighboring countries claimed to change its policy. The government launched a national action plan 1 year later. Have the claims of change in policy borne out? VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports.
School children singing, promising to educate the enemy's kids in revenge for the attack that killed more than 140 people a year ago. An example of the kinds of television advertisements Pakistan's military has produced since last December. That attack on a school in Peshawar rallied the country against extremists. Political analyst Hassan Askari Rizvi says recent developments have seen a change in mindset.
And that is, they have started viewing these extremist terrorist groups as a major threat to Pakistan.
But the trust deficit in the region remains high. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The agreement out of Paris is very strong in some senses and very weak in others. So I would say the strongest elements are that it's universal, that all countries have agreed to a plan for their action towards climate change. It has different expectations of the wealthy countries and the poorer countries based on both their ability to do stuff, but then also how much they contributed to the problem. That's called differentiation.
That's Timmons Roberts, Senior Fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution, and he's also Professor of Environmental Sciences and Sociology at Brown University. He's speaking on the climate deal that took place in Paris. We'll have full details coming up. Also, the UN Special Envoy for Libya is continuing negotiations on a unity agreement after the leaders of the country's two rival legislatures rejected the deal. The EU is trying to use foreign aid to end the flow of more than 200,000 African migrants into Europe. And a Muslim rebel leader in Central African Republic declares an autonomous state in the country's north. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Arab media is reporting the UN Special Envoy for Libya is continuing negotiations on a unity agreement after the leaders of the country's two rival legislatures rejected the deal that was to be signed today in Morocco. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
A small crowd applauded as Libya's rival parliament speakers Nouri Boussahmane and Akila Saleh grasped hands and lifted them in the air in a gesture of unity during talks in Malta. But both men acknowledged a final agreement had yet to be reached. Speaker Akila Saleh of the Tobruk-based Libyan parliament told a news conference it was necessary to put together a broad-based government. He says that he has asked the UN envoy's office to postpone the naming of the members of Libya's unity government so as to be sure they represent the authentic will of the people. Speaker Nouri Boussahmane of the Tripoli-based General National Congress indicated the final agreement had been put off in order to iron out a number of disagreements. He says that the agreement has been postponed for several days due to logistic reasons, and committees will meet soon to discuss all the outstanding disagreements. Al Arabiya TV reported UN Special Envoy Martin Kobler was meeting with members of the Libyan parliament in the eastern town of Baida to try to hammer out a final deal. Tripoli-based parliament member Abu Bakr Ahmed told Libyan TV Western delegations are due in Morocco for a signing ceremony they expect will take place Thursday. Jabala Ashaibani of the rival Tobruk-based parliament indicated he was not pleased with the way the final agreement was shaping up. He claims the United Nations is proposing a protectorate representing European and Western interests and is not concerned about the worries or interests of the Libyan people. Analyst Ismail Mahaishi told Libya's Al Ahrar TV the basis of the UN brokered deal is to avoid either side triumphing over the other and to pressure both to compromise. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A Muslim rebel leader in Central African Republic has declared an autonomous state in the country's north, further defying efforts to end 3 years of bloody instability. Nordine Adam, the leader of the Seleka rebel faction that overthrew President Francois Bozizé in 2013, proclaimed his stronghold, the Republic of Lagone, in a statement released Monday from the town of Cabo Bangora. The declaration could derail the results of a referendum held Sunday on a proposed constitution for the small nation of nearly 5 million people. Voting in some areas was disrupted by sporadic violence, prompting UN peacekeepers to intervene and bolster security. The referendum was a prelude to national elections that are planned for December 27th. A spokesman for CAR's transitional government issued a statement Tuesday urging the international community and UN forces in the country to do everything possible to neutralize the capacity of these terrorists to do harm. UN peacekeepers took down the Rebel Republic's flag after it was raised over the local police station in the northern town of Indele. The U.S. State Department issued a statement Tuesday praising the successful completion of the constitutional referendum, as it showed Central Africans' clear desire to decide their country's future at the ballot box rather than allowing those with weapons to determine the future of their nation. The U.S. Embassy in Abuja says the Nigerian government should quickly investigate a clash between the Nigerian military and members of a Shiite Muslim sect that reportedly left hundreds dead. Amnesty International and the Iranian government have joined the call for an immediate investigation. Activists and leaders of the Islamic Movement for Nigeria say up to 1,000 Shiite Muslims were killed in army raids in the town of Zaria. The army says troops were responding to what it calls an assassination attempt on Nigeria's Army Chief of Staff, General Tukar Baratai. The sect's leaders say the army was carrying out a pre-planned attack. The military has arrested Ibrahim Zakzaki, the head of the sect, among other Zaria residents. The Muslim sect seeks to establish an Islamic State in northern Nigeria and is known to have links to Iran. Yesterday, Iran's foreign minister summoned the top Nigerian diplomat to Tehran to protest the killings. The Iranian parliament demanded an investigation. Iranian state TV says Iran's president Hussein Rouhani called Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to condemn the killings. The government in Tehran considers itself the guardian of the Shiite Muslim faith. The sect is not connected to Boko Haram, the Islamic radical sect blamed for more than 10,000 deaths in Nigeria over the past 6 years. Now that a global climate agreement has been reached, the hard part begins. Countries must now implement their plans to deal with rising global temperatures, even though the plans fall short of targets. The goal was to keep rising temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels of the year 1750. But many observers believe temperatures will rise at 3 degrees by the end of the century. One of those attending the Paris Climate Conference last week was Timmins Roberts, senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution and professor of environmental sciences and sociology at Brown University. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the climate deal.
The agreement out of Paris is very strong in some senses and very weak in others. So I would say the strongest elements are that it's universal, that all countries have agreed to a plan for their action towards climate change. It has different expectations of the wealthy countries and the poorer countries based on both their ability to do stuff, but then also how much they contributed to the problem. That's called differentiation. The weaker side is that it's voluntary. It's built on a system called pledge and review, which is very interesting because when it first came out in 2009 in the Copenhagen Accord, this idea of pledging that each country would pledge what it wanted to do, what it thought it could do, and then putting in a plan to the international community through this thing called an INDC or an intended nationally determined contribution, those seem to be quite inadequate. And the first round of those kind of pledges were not very good. But this year, in 2005, we've seen pledges come in from about 187 countries, virtually the entire world community. And the pledges add up to reductions that are substantial in the amount of warming that we're likely to see. Now, it's not enough. We're about halfway towards what we need to get to. But the Paris framework is also very good in that it creates a structure for these to be sort of ratcheted up or improved every 5 years. What Paris really does is set in place a system for countries to put out there what they want to do, what they think they can do, and then have it reviewed and upgraded every 5 years.
So we have to wait 5 years to find out whether the previous 5 years were effective or not?
Pretty much. I think that's right. There will be a global stock take every 5 years. The next one should be around 2020. Now, what I think is really interesting is literally within minutes of gaveling this plan, the president of France, François Hollande, then went on to say that we're going to do more than we pledged. And I think that's the key, is that really this is the time now for civil society, for citizens, industry, and so on, to see what they can do, what they can push their governments and their economy to do better than we promised, because that's really the only way we're going to get to the safe levels that are actually laid out in the plan of well below 2 degrees of warming, or attempting to reach 1.5 degrees to stay below that.
I've spoke with a number of analysts leading up to the agreement, and they looked at the country commitments, and they said, as it stands now, they're not going to reach that 2-degree limit. It looks more like it would probably be 3 degrees Celsius.
Right. I've seen estimates that range from 2.7 to almost 3.5 degrees. But we're heading in the right direction. I mean, before this year, we were headed to, you know, almost a degree higher for almost all of those estimates. So a lot depends on how you model the time after 2030 and whether you expect each of the plans to be fully met. I mean, that's another huge thing, is that all of our estimates depend on countries coming through on their promises. There's really not an enforcement mechanism in the agreement. So I think that's one of its great weaknesses.
After so many meetings where there were no results, why do you think the Paris conference ended up with this agreement?
So there's a number of reasons why Paris was successful. I think 2015 is a very different year than 2009. The economy is better. People are perceiving climate change in a new way. The Pope went out and has been talking about climate change around the world as a moral issue and one that requires everyone to act. Renewables have gotten cheaper. And then the big two, the U.S. and China, actually started moving in the last little over a year, starting with a big joint announcement in November of 2014. So it's a different kind of a year. Secondly, the French team was masterful. They went around the world and talked to the key players all throughout the year. They led a brilliant set of negotiations in Paris where there was a level of trust that I have never seen in these negotiations. And then thirdly, this plan, this idea of a more voluntary agreement was a good system that seems to actually bring together the countries of the world in a way that they want to be participants.
Was there any danger in your view of the November terrorist attacks in Paris overshadowing the climate conference and possibly derailing it?
Absolutely. You know, I was bringing a team of 15 students to Paris, and I was concerned, and I think I was worried a lot about the news coverage switching entirely to this sort of fear and, you know, what are we going to do to respond approach to the terrorist attacks, which is natural. When I got to Paris about 4 or 5 days before the talk started, things were already shifting and returning to normal, and I think the amount of time between the attacks and the actual negotiations did help get things back on track. And with 140 or 50 world leaders showing up there, really gave a boost to the negotiations.
Timmons Roberts is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of environmental sciences and sociology at Brown University. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Amnesty International says Turkey has rounded up scores of refugees and asylum seekers since September and transported them to detention centers. In a report released today, Amnesty says some were mistreated or forcibly returned to Syria and Iraq. The actions occurred at the same time that Turkish-EU migration talks were going on. Amnesty warns that the EU risk being complicit in serious human rights violations. Turkey hosts the world's largest number of refugees, including 2.2 million Syrians. The Greek Coast Guard says a helicopter, patrol boats, and fishing boats are combing an area north of Lesbos for survivors of a boat carrying dozens of migrants that sank. The EU has announced actions worth an estimated $327 million to address the root causes of irregular migration and displacement. The EU says the measures are supposed to the economic and social development of the migrants' countries of origin. This includes a package of $276 million for the Horn of Africa. The European Union is trying to use foreign aid to end the flow of more than 200,000 African migrants into Europe. Some observers say if that's how they plan to reduce the traffic across the Mediterranean, it won't work. VOA's David Arnold reports.
Deputy Director of Amnesty International's Europe and Central Asia office, Gary Van Gulik, says the negotiations that took place with individual countries raise many questions.
We are worried, certainly, that the deals are being made, especially country by country, saying, look, this is what you get if you do indeed stop refugees from coming to Europe. We're worried about border guards being funded by the EU in certain countries. We're concerned that we're going to see camps in African countries to keep people away from Europe. That's not quite happening yet. So we're going to follow this and monitor it. But slightly removed from that is the notion that as long as you give a lot of development aid to certain countries, you're going to prevent movement. Don't pretend that you're going to stop people fleeing conflict, fleeing persecution, just because the standard of living may have gone up a little bit. Frankly, this is all about keeping people out. In the end, this is what it's about.
EU officials say these development aid packages will likely lower migrant flows from Nigeria, Mali, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. But an African development expert says it won't work unless it's in the best interests of the governments. Stephen Radelet is an economist and a professor of the practice of global development at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. In his book, The Great Surge, The Ascent of the Developing World, Radelet writes about how development aid affects African economies. But he doesn't think this development aid package from the EU will keep Africans out of Europe.
It's certainly correct, I think, that that's a good way to interpret it. For that reason, I don't think it's going to work. One of the things that we've learned is that you cannot give countries money to ask them to do what is not in their basic interest. You can use aid to help push countries move faster and to help support them in what they want to do. That is, if they really do want to strengthen their health system or their education system. But when we ask countries to do things that they wouldn't actually put as a top priority, providing strings with aid money is just not going to work.
He says remittances are another factor working against a slowdown in migration. The funds that Somalis, Nigerians, and Ethiopians earn in the United States and in Europe and then send home to their families boost the national economies of those African countries.
Migrants leaving and then earning money that they send as remittances back home is beneficial to the countries and to their families. What the EU is asking countries to do is to stop doing that and to use resources to stop people from doing that they might otherwise use for education or health or other social structures.
Radelet says the European Union has been a generous provider of development funds to Africa, but he says the $2 billion offered at the Malta summit are not enough.
Well, the EU has a long history of aid to Africa, starting in the post-colonial period, that has come both from the EU itself and from its member countries on a range of topics, from health to education to economic growth. The current amount is relatively small. I don't think it's conceived particularly well, and I actually don't think it's going to get at the root cause of the problems. And in fact, no amount of aid by itself is going to turn many of these countries around. The problems are rooted in difficulties in governance and other structures that aid alone can't remedy. It could help, but it can't remedy it by itself.
He says 19 countries in Africa are improving their economies. The rest are not. The difference is governance. Migrants tend to leave countries where the governance is not good.
The real solution is improving conditions at home. The countries in the worst shape are the least likely to use aid well, but they're the most likely to have migrants leaving. Sudan is a perfect example. It's a place that's not governed very well, and providing them with aid, the aid is unlikely to be used well, and therefore it's unlikely to turn things around. So I think for those reasons, the trust fund is likely to be ineffective.
Governance is not the only driver causing migrants to cross the Mediterranean. They're also looking for work, even when their own country's economies are growing.
There are lots of opportunities at home for Ethiopia. The economy is growing very fast. It's such a big country, however, that even though Ethiopia is doing fairly well, there are not as many opportunities for others as there might be. Nigeria is perhaps turning the corner politically with the very successful elections that they had earlier this year, but they are struggling economically because the price of oil is down. In the other countries, Mali, Eritrea, and in Sudan, there's a longer history of lackluster economic performance, and of course in Mali, accentuated by the recent bombings in Bamako. So people do not see great opportunities, economic opportunities at home, and all of their incentives are to move to other countries in Europe where there are better job opportunities.
It's not clear if European leaders will respond to critics and restructure their $2 billion aid plan, but Radelet is sure that without changes, the effort is not likely to achieve its goals. This is VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
For practically no cost, young men on the streets of the Malian capital, Bamako, will put the latest hit songs onto your cell phone or memory stick. They are called telechargers or downloaders. With limited means to stop the pirating of their songs, musicians are now using the downloaders to promote their work. Katerina Hoye has more from Bamako.
When Sidiki Diabate, the son of Mali's choir master, Tumani Diabate, wanted to promote his latest release, he did not bother with radio TV spots. Instead, he sent his manager to Fankele Diara Street to see the telechargers. The young men crouch over the laptops. They transfer tunes to mobile phones and USB sticks for as little as 4 cents a song. Sidiki is the most asked for artist. Playing his music on slow days can draw dozens of customers. Downloader Al Fuseini Balu says the street is like a market. If you want to reach people, this is where you go, he says. You can't sell cassettes and CDs anymore. Everyone uses memory cards. Frequent power cuts and a spotty internet that is still too expensive for many Malians have created a niche for the city's tech-savvy youth.
Bon, c'est-à-dire les chansons qui sont à mode, on sait. On connaît les chansons qui fait bouger la.
Downloader Aboubakar Koulibaly says, we know the popular songs, the tunes that make people dance. He says, people always looking for the latest songs. If I like a particular song, I'll recommend it. The most popular request is Malian rap. These days, rappers are the only ones, besides religious leaders, who can sell out Bamako's big stadiums. And the internet is pushing the African music industry toward new business models, ones that are turning mobile phone companies into the new record labels. Malian rapper Milmo recently signed a lucrative sponsorship deal with the mobile provider Orange Mali. His new releases are only available from Orange, bought by way of Orange mobile money. Other artists have signed up with Malian mobile companies Malitel or Sutelma. But not all artists are happy to see their records ripped and shared on the street. The street downloaders do not share their profits.
Bon, même si c'est pas moi, ils savent que la musique quand même, si c'est.
If I don't download it, someone else will, says Koulibaly. Some artists still release albums, but with new technology, everything is online. The artists don't make money selling records anymore. They make money playing concerts, he says. The Malian Federation of Musicians has struggled to fight pirating. In 2014, the government granted the association a $1 cut from every SIM card sold by mobile phone companies. But that tax was later overturned in court. Meanwhile, long-standing record labels like Mali Cassette are struggling to compete with the new technology and distribution methods. And musicians rely on weddings, the rare paid gig, and for lucky few, international tours to earn a living. Katerina Höje for VOA News, Bamako.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Shao Gunn, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.